This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 13, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado. Public interest groups fight against a Bush administration proposal that they say puts local communities and the environment at risk. After a year of complaints, firings, and resignations, Walter Reed opens a new center for amputee vets. And intensive Arabic school instruction is just enough to spark a controversy for a Brooklyn middle school. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The United Nations General Assembly has adopted the Universal Declaration of Indigenous Peoples. The vote came after more than two decades of debate. The United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand voted against the non-binding treaty to recognize Indigenous rights. President Bush is to address the nation tonight in a speech about the war in Iraq. This, as a key U.S. ally in the region, died in a bomb attack. Hiba Dawood has more.
Sotara Borisha was a founding member and leader of the Anbar Salvation Council, an alliance of Sunni tribal forces opposed to Al-Qaeda. In the past 2 years, Al-Qaeda killed Sotara Borisha's father and his three brothers. Borisha died along with two of his bodyguards today when a bomb exploded near his home in Ramadi in the rest of Anbar province. President Bush met with Borisha and other tribal leaders during a surprise visit to the Anbar province 10 days ago. The Anbar Salvation Council has been carrying out a campaign to push Al-Qaeda members out of the province. Many suspect Al-Qaeda carried out today's attack in order to cripple the Anbar Salvation Council and others who cooperate with the Americans. Elsewhere in Iraq, five people died and 10 others were wounded today when a car bomb exploded near a police convoy in eastern Baghdad. This is Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Hurricane Umberto dumped up to 15 inches of rain onto parts of the Texas Gulf Coast this morning. It then moved towards Louisiana as a tropical storm. Umberto was the first hurricane in 2 years to make landfall in the U.S. A fourth major earthquake has struck Indonesia, while the death toll from previous quakes has climbed to 10. Chad Bouchard reports from Jakarta.
The most recent quake struck near the western coast of Sumatra, which has been hit with a series of powerful tremors since Wednesday. Between earthquakes and aftershocks over the last 24 hours, the archipelago nation has seen more than 30 seismic jolts. Another quake struck earlier in the day east of Sumatra near the island of Sulawesi. Indonesian officials issued a tsunami warning there, but quickly lifted it. On Sumatra, rescuers continue digging through the wreckage of hundreds of toppled buildings. The death toll is expected to rise, but officials say the damage appears to be less severe than they initially feared. Meanwhile, seismologists say the island is lucky to have escaped a devastating tsunami. The initial Sumatra quake did trigger a powerful ocean wave, but it moved toward the open ocean rather than toward land. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
A series of government-initiated public hearings on cultural differences and immigrant integration began this week in Quebec. FSRN's Stéphane Christophe reports from Montreal.
Immigrants in Quebec have faced a growing political storm throughout the past year as a provincial debate on what is referred to as reasonable accommodation has attracted international headlines. A series of public hearings will occur throughout the coming months in Quebec as part of the State Commission led by two Quebec academics who are not new immigrants. Nazila Batash is with No One Is Illegal in Montreal.
Using the term accommodation, simply put, really sort of implies to me a hierarchy of identities to begin with, whereby the identity, the one that's been framed in the mainstream media, is a so-called Québécois national identity. So the identity of the white settler prevails, and the action of quote-unquote allowing the expression of religious or faith-based identity, that of the quote-unquote newcomer, is an accommodation to begin with.
Debate on immigration in Quebec reached extremes in the past year when the rural town of Huronville passed a resolution which demanded that, quote, new arrivals abandon the way of life from their countries of origin as it cannot be recreated in Quebec. Civil liberties groups throughout Canada slammed the resolution as racist. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Stéphane Christophe in Montreal.
A U.S. attorney has announced that prosecutors will not pursue federal hate crimes charges against six people, all white, accused of kidnapping, sexually assaulting, and torturing a young African-American woman in West Virginia. Police found 20-year-old Megan Williams on Saturday in a private residence based on an anonymous tip. She had been held there for 7 days. Her captors allegedly sexually assaulted her while yelling racist slurs, stabbed her and cut her, and forced her to eat animal feces and drink water from the toilet. The six suspects included a mother and son and a father and daughter. All have criminal records. Logan County, West Virginia officials may still bring charges under state-level hate crimes laws. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Public interest groups are fighting against a Bush administration proposal that would expand the reach of mountaintop coal mining, a practice that they say puts local communities and the environment at risk. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Ed Wiley has worked in coal mines his entire life. Now he's fighting the very industry that has employed him and many in his West Virginia community.
As parents and grandparents, you know, we have to stand up for our children's future. And it's a serious issue, and I made a vow to them little kids. It hurt me that day my granddaughter come out of there sick, and it's just like somebody took a sledgehammer and hit me. It really woke me up on a lot of issues.
His granddaughter's elementary school is at the base of a mountaintop coal mining site. He blames her illness on the sludge and waste the mine produces. He's taken his activism to new levels. He walked to Washington, D.C. from West Virginia last year, and now he's in New York for the month. He will stand outside NBC's Today Show holding signs, hoping his message gets on national TV.
Catch the eye of the Today Show, and hopefully to get on and tell our story, what's happening. America needs to know. We are paying a price, our children are paying a price, our land, but how it will affect all the kids. His future around America. It's a serious problem, and America's really being misled.
One of the main concerns of activists opposed to mountaintop removal is the mine's excess filling up streams that run through the valleys, polluting the waterways and cutting off water access. And the Bush administration has proposed a new rule that would affect those streams. It is one of the most significant changes to mountaintop removal in years. The mining companies would have to seek approval from regulators before they can place their excess mountain in the waterways. Environmentalists say it does away with the 100-foot rule that prohibits the remnants being laid near the edge of a stream. Marie Ogano is with the Ohio Valley Environmentalist Coalition.
Taking away this 100 feet of protection for our streams, for our headwater streams, basically what it's doing, it's allowing the coal companies to pollute the aquifers. Where people get their water from here. It's allowing the coal companies to pollute the streams, not only to pollute the streams, but to bury them. In West Virginia, we've got more than 1,000 miles of streams that's been buried forever.
Despite the current policy, coal companies have been filling the streams with sediment anyways, and environmentalists have taken them to court, saying they are violating federal regulation. Luke Popovich with the National Mining Association welcomes the new rule because he says it will clear up confusion, even though, he says, the process will be burdensome to mining companies.
This rule will not change policy one bit. It will not increase mountaintop mining. It's not going to make the rivers and streams of the United States suddenly dirty in these areas.
The rule is currently in a public comment period, but opponents have an uphill battle. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the mining industry has given nearly $12 million in campaign donations since 2000, 80% of that going to Republicans. And even with Democrats in control of Congress, one of mining's biggest supporters is head of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee, Robert Byrd of West Virginia. And West Virginia is one of the poorest states in the country and relies on the coal industry for employment. Congress is expected to take up energy legislation this fall, and the coal lobby will be pushing for so-called clean coal technology, hoping to give the industry another boost amidst recent coal mine disasters and fears of coal's contribution to global warming. Ed Wiley says he understands all those concerns, but he sees opportunities. For one, he says, they could make use of the trees that are cut for mining.
What's wrong with putting furniture factories in here? We have a lot of craftsmen that are good woodworking craftsmen. We have skills to do other things. You know, we can pack it, we can build it, we can assemble it. We have major railways that come in. We have major interstates. You know, we could do more than just mine coal. We just need these people to come in and give us an opportunity to show them.
The public comment period with the Department of Interior is open until October. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. The Walter Reed Medical Center opened its new Military Advanced Training Center for soldier amputees today to provide services for many of the more than 600 veterans who have lost a limb in Afghanistan or Iraq. Walter Reed Medical has been at the center of a storm in the past year, and the Army's top civilian official resigned in March due to a controversy over inadequate care there. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
With military paratroopers and the Army band in tow, hundreds gathered in the sun on the front lawn of the Walter Reed Medical Center for the grand opening of its new Military Advanced Training Center.
Please stand and join me in welcoming to the stage today's official party, and remain standing for the playing of the national anthem.
The center is designed to provide improved services for amputees and those soldiers with illnesses that impair the functions of one or two limbs. General Eric Shoemaker is commander of the Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
This very important event here for the Walter Reed team and family and for the entire Joint Medical Force, a medical force that's represented here today by the Navy and in white and khaki, by the Air Force in blue, and by the academic gowns of our medical school at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, all of whom are committed to caring for and restoring the function of warriors injured or ill in the service to their nation.
The center is part of the Army's Warriors in Transition program, which aims to get soldiers back to the highest level of activity in the shortest amount of time. Again, General Shoemaker.
Soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, civilians who have lost function, a limb, an eye, hearing, balance, orientation, or motor skills, but never have lost their fighting spirit or their warrior ethos. They are committed to restoring their capacity to serve this nation as warriors or as productive citizens.
Back in 2004, Congress approved funds for the new center, which cost about $10 million and was finished ahead of schedule. House Defense Committee Representative and Democrat from Pennsylvania, John Murtha.
I'll tell you, there's not many projects that come in under cost and on time. This was 2 months in advance.
Earlier in the year, there were repeated complaints from soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan about substandard care. Response to the grievances resulted in the resignation of several top medical military officials at the Walter Reed facility. Back in July, the President's Commission on Care for America's Wounded Warriors issued its final report, which recommended fundamental changes in the medical care and disability systems for the Department of Defense. The report put a renewed emphasis on taking care of servicemen and women and their families when they came back injured. Staff Sergeant Benton Sims is part of the Warrior Transition Brigade, a unit that assists with soldiers when they get injured and come to the new center.
They get a squad leader, a platoon, and everything, and we make sure that their family's taken care of, as in with lodging, any things, the problems they have up in the hospital, we try to take care of and just have accountability and make sure they meet in the appointments, and like I said, any issues they have in the hospital, we go through the case managers and try to get anything solved, any issues they have.
The facilities will house physicians, nurses, and VA social workers. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Thank you.
York's Khalil Gibran International Academy, a middle school in Brooklyn, nearly shut its doors before it ever opened for the fall semester. The school, inspired by the works of Gibran, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King Jr., offers a multicultural curriculum and intensive Arabic language instruction, which, as FSRN's Zoe Sullivan reports, was enough to cause a firestorm of controversy.
The Khalil Gibran International Academy, an Arabic dual-language middle school in Brooklyn, opened its doors last week. A few years ago, in an effort to promote understanding of Arabic culture, members of the New York Arab community approached the Department of Education about establishing a school. But in the summer leading up to its opening, the academy's then-principal, Debbie Almontasser, came under fire in conservative dailies The New York Post and The New York Sun. People such as Daniel Pipes, the director of the neoconservative Middle East Forum, called for the school to be shut down.
An Arabic school in the abstract is a good idea. There's a national security need for more speakers of Arabic. Learning it starting from the age of 12 is a good idea. I started at 19. It was tough. But there are problems inherent to teaching Arabic. There is a tendency to bring along politics and religion.
Pipes and others believe that teaching Arabic language and culture is inherently charged with anti-American religion and politics.
Arabic is the language of Islam and therefore is associated with Islam. I can testify that when I was studying Arabic, it was generally assumed by Arabic speakers that I was on my way to conversion toward Islam. And then it's highly politicized and therefore there's a political element. No, I don't think there's any other language that has such a political and religious quality to its instruction, as does Arabic.
Leina Al-Husseini is the executive director of the Arab American Family Support Center, the lead community partner for the Khalil Gibran School.
We're teaching Arabic. We're not teaching religion. So we're not teaching Islam or any other religion. If 67% of Arab Americans are Christian, you know, that in itself blows his whole thesis to bits.
Al-Husseini.
The thing that disturbed me is this whole idea, if you're teaching Arabic, you're creating a madrasa, which, by the way, in Arabic means a school. No more, no less, that's all it is. Here it's meant with this religious connotation. And again, that's lack of understanding. And honestly, to me, that's racism. You know, stereotyping and pure, pure racism.
Al-Husseini explains the aspirations that the parents of Khalil Gibran's students have for their children.
A lot of the parents say, you know, maybe my son will end up working at the UN or my daughter will end up working at the State Department. One woman said, I hope my son might be sitting one day on discussing peace. People are looking at it from a career opportunity and doing something, giving back to the world and looking at it in terms of globalization, how their students can compete in tomorrow's world.
There has been clear anti-Arab and anti-Muslim feeling in the hostile newspaper articles and commentary on the school. An interviewer from the New York Post asked Principal Debbie Almontasser about a T-shirt an Arab American group had produced, reading Intifada NYC, when she responded, accurately, that Intifada means simply shaking off. Almontasser, who worked with Jewish and other groups after the 9/11 bombings to promote tolerance and understanding, was characterized as an apologist for violence. She has since resigned. Despite the controversy, the school has now opened. Bridget Robbins is a music teacher at the academy. She has spent half of her life studying Arabic and Middle Eastern music. She talks about her hopes for the school.
But what I'm so excited about this school for is that it's a step in the right direction of a place where some of these misconceptions and misunderstandings can start getting done away with, and people will be forced to see the Middle East as a diverse place with a lot of different ideologies, religions, make us not be able to dehumanize the place. I mean, put a human face on these people, on this place.
Respect for minorities is one of the essential aspects of a real democracy. The Khalil Gibran International Academy has overcome the challenge raised against its opening. Time will tell if it can accomplish its mission of dispelling stereotypes and promoting understanding. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Zoe Sullivan in New York.
Nepal appears to be gearing towards holding a constituent assembly poll that's expected to usher a new political order in the country. But the path to that new order is full of potholes. The Nepali Congress, led by Premier Girja Prasad Koirala, has followed a constitutional monarchy since its inception in the late 1940s, but the Central Working Committee has recently decided to opt for a republic in its place. PC Dubey reports from Kathmandu.
On November 22nd, Nepal will elect a constituent assembly to draft a new democratic constitution. Two of the most contentious issues are the future of the monarchy and the question of regional autonomy to various marginalized ethnic groups. On September 6th, the Central Working Committee of the Nepali Congress, which has long insisted on a constitutional monarchy, decided to abandon that stance. Chakraprasad Bastola, a member of the Central Working Committee of the Nepali Congress, acknowledged that his party would be isolated at the Constituent Assembly if it continued to insist on retaining the monarchy.
So we have taken the decision to opt for republic to escape such embarrassment. We feel this is our correct political decision.
But the decision has provoked opposition within the party. Sujata Koirala, a CWC member and the daughter of Nepalese Premier Koirala, says it goes against the fundamental policy of Nepal's oldest party.
I have no infatuation with the king. I support the fight against autocratic monarchy. But if the king is needed for the good of the country, we have to retain him. We must go for reconciliation.
With such high-profile Congress members against it, it is possible the party will at reverse this decision. Ravikant Mishra, a Madhesi political analyst, says full democracy would end the hegemony of the hill people known as Pahari over the numerically dominant but politically marginal Madhesis, a change the Pahari leaders could not accept.
This brazenly exposes the ugly ethnic politics of Nepal, where both Maoist ideology and democracy are mere tools to safeguard the Pahari people's grip over power.
Mishra says Maoists, whose top leadership also hails from the Hill fraternity, could align themselves with their long rivals in the Nepali Congress in order to postpone November's election and put off Madhesi demands for greater power. This despite an agreement reached between Premier Koirala's government and the leaders of the Madhesi People's Rights Forum, MPRF, which has been spearheading the Madhesi demands for greater representation. The agreement stipulates that after the election, the Constituent Assembly would incorporate a federal system of governance with various regions enjoying a degree of autonomy. The agreement may be too little, too late. Several new political armed groups have mushroomed in the Madhesi region demanding total autonomy. Jwala Singh, leader of the armed Madhesi group Tarai Mukti Morcha, has dubbed the MPRF government treaty a betrayal of the Madhesi interests. He has vowed to fight for independence and foil November 22nd election.
This truce is a hoax, and the Pahari leaders' puppets have gone for it. They have simply betrayed our people. Madhesis would never forgive them. We will fight to end the Pahari hegemony.
Add to this discontent with the demobilization of 30,000 Maoist guerrillas and the prospects of a hitch-free constituent assembly election seem remote. Baburam Bhattrai is deputy leader of the Maoists.
The government has failed to fulfill its pledges to rehabilitate our guerrillas and foster a culture of democracy. So in this situation, a constituent assembly poll is not possible.
Government's top leaders insist the poll will go ahead, but as violence grows, so do fears that Nepal's fragile political transformation is in danger. From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Massacre,
What massacre? Haditha. The calendar has shed weeks and many months since the name Haditha steered so many people in Iraq, the U.S., and around the world. Within days of its announcement came the horror of recognition. It reminded us all of the carnage of Vietnam's My Lai massacre, where women, babies, dogs, and chickens shared the sleep of death in a tropical ditch. It differed from Vietnam only in its scope and number, but in every sense of which the word massacre may be used, this was it. For here, in the Iraqi city of Haditha, women, children, old men, and young were swept away from life by the automatic weapons fire of American guns held in American hands, an apparent retaliation for an IED blast which killed an American soldier several hours earlier. Here, U.S. soldiers entered Iraqi homes on free fire, unloading on anything moving or not moving quickly enough. Well, the U.S. military justice system has finished its work, and voila, except for a few letters of censure, the military form of reprimand, no one has been punished for the Haditha massacre. Indeed, one might ask, albeit facetiously, what massacre? For it seems that no U.S. military rules of engagement were violated, and if U.S. military judges are to be believed, no war crimes occurred. Of the dead Iraqi women and children, they were not victims of American killers in uniform. They were victims of the nebulous fog of war. In war, stuff happens. Let's move on. One military prosecutor said he declined to punish the soldiers further because to do so would harm unit morale. That's U.S. justice for all the world to see, the law of the occupier. If ever we engaged in the illusion that the puppets in government in Iraq were little more than U.S. stringed mannequins, their silence on Haditha is evidence enough. Dozens of Iraqi civilians were slain in their homes, under their beds, while holding their babies, unarmed, and the U.S. imperial government issues its final ruling. No harm, no foul. We're looking at something that will mark the world for a generation. It is the poisoning of imperialism, which warps the mind and stains the soul with the semblance of superiority. Massacre? What massacre? Only some Arabs were killed. To the empire, they don't count. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Antonio Ortiz and Jin Lei. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.